From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is His Excellency Sir Peter Westmacott, British Ambassador to the United States since 2012. This is Sir Peter's second posting in Washington, having previously served as the British Embassy's Counselor for Political and Public Affairs in the mid-1990s. And we're coming to you from the Ambassador's residence in Washington on Monday, November 23rd. Prior to his service as Ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott served as the British Ambassador to France and Turkey. He has also been posted in Tehran and Brussels. Ambassador Westmacott also served as Director for the Americas in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. In addition, he served as Deputy Private Secretary to His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales from 1990 to 1993. On this edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk with Sir Peter Westmacott about the fallout from the Paris terror attacks, the impact on the migrant refugee crisis, Britain's upcoming referendum on membership in the EU, as well as a number of issues important to the U.S.-UK bilateral relationship, including trade and climate talks. Well, Sir Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We're so delighted that you have welcomed us here at your residence. Well, first off, Sir Peter, we know that Prime Minister Cameron met with President François Hollande this week to talk about what to do in the wake of the terrible terror attacks. And we know that he pledged greater cooperation on all fronts and also adding airstrikes in Syria to combat ISIL. Talk more about what came of that meeting.
Well, the Prime Minister, as you say, went to Paris and saw the President, and they went together to the site of where the biggest of the atrocities took place at that nightclub. And they did indeed discuss the way in which the British and the French can further improve their solidarity, working together to deal with the scourge that is ISIS. We haven't yet decided in the United Kingdom that we will take military action inside Syria, as we are already doing in Iraq. We're doing a great deal there in lots of different ways, whether it's encountering IED, airstrikes, providing weapons for the Kurds fighting back against ISIL, or whether it's providing aerial reconnaissance and refueling to other people's fighter aircraft. We're doing a huge amount there. Inside Syria, we're doing a bit less. We've been doing some train and equip like the Americans have, and we've been providing some of the overhead intelligence and reconnaissance, but we've not been taking military action there. And what the Prime Minister has said today is that he will be making the case for a strategic approach towards the problems of ISIL in both Syria and Iraq to Parliament later this week, and that he will be seeking parliamentary approval for British military action to be extended from Iraq into Syria in the future. I don't yet know when that'll be, but that is the Prime Minister's intention. And the point that he makes is that the terrorists don't recognise any national border, so why would the British, as part of the coalition to counter that terrorist threat, recognise the border?
We'll talk more about the Syria theater in a little bit, but I want to go to the implications for Britain about the terror attacks in France. Certainly, Britain has had its share of attacks. I'd like to get your sense of what you think might have gone wrong, particularly with respect to any kinds of intelligence failures, lack of coordination. What are the challenges and obstacles to tracking and foiling these plots?
I think the point to remember when you're dealing with this kind of terrorist threat is that the bad guys have to get lucky just once, whereas the forces of goodness and truth, the forces of law and order, have to be vigilant and successful all the time if we are to stop any attacks. So, of course, after an event like this, everybody immediately looks at the intelligence and the traces they left behind to see what more we can learn about who they were, where they came from, who tasked them, and what further risks and threats there might be. So I myself wouldn't talk about weaknesses and failures and why didn't we stop it. It is really very difficult to be 100% sure. We've all been working on this for a long time. My Prime Minister has made clear the last few months we've stopped numerous ISIL-sponsored terrorist attacks in the United Kingdom. Who knows? The next successful attack could be in any one of a number of different cities. Doesn't mean to say that our intelligence services are not geared up, expanding their operations, improving their cooperation, but it does mean that we have to be even more vigilant and we have to be as strong as we can in learning the lessons from what's gone on. And one of the things that we are doing with our French friends and with our Belgian friends and our partners across Europe, as well as here in the United States, is trying to ensure that we've all got access to the same critical information so that we can head off this kind of thing before the next atrocity.
Well, speaking of this sharing of intelligence, that leads us, of course, to the problem of border security. Now, while Britain is not part of the Schengen area, to what extent do you think that these open borders among so many of the European Union countries might be, you know, under threat, that there will be greater, of course, border security. What impact might this have on Schengen rules that allow, you know, cross-border access?
Yeah. Well, this whole issue of migration combined with the terrorist threat is a huge crisis, which is difficult for all of us to deal with. It is an existential issue, frankly, for the future of a borderless European Union. So there's two angles to it, really. One is the very large number of migrants fleeing countries where their life is no longer safe, a lot of them from Syria, but not only from Syria. We have migrants and refugees arriving from Afghanistan and Eritrea and Somalia, as well as from Syria and Iraq. So there are very large numbers of people coming into Europe, which are putting a real pressure on the ability of those countries to absorb such very large numbers, as we have seen over the last few months. And then separately, you've got terrorists who have in many cases been born and brought up in European countries and gone to the region, coming back radicalized as foreign fighters and determined to come back across the border. So we have both to manage a very large humanitarian migration issue, and we have to ensure that we can keep tabs on people who have got ill intent, terrorist plans coming across our borders with too much facility. So the two fit together. What does that mean for the future of Schengen and so on? Well, the European Union is looking at that very carefully. We've already seen that a number of member states are having to put up their own national frontiers. They are tightening controls where there were none before. In many cases, the border posts were there, but they were largely, you know, ineffective and not necessary. Now they are. For us, we're outside Schengen, as you say, and we're also protected by 25 miles of sea, which makes it a little bit easier for the United Kingdom to, if you like, manage its own borders. But I think it means that Europe both has to address the future of Schengen, which may mean that some changes need to be made, but that's up to the member states concerned to decide. But also those of us who are outside Schengen, we will be even more anxious to ensure that our national border controls are effective so that we pick these people up at the border before they've had a chance to do harm.
I wanted to follow on about Europe being, or some parts of Europe, and of course Belgium in particular with the Molenbeek neighborhood, these breeding grounds for Islamist terrorists. Talk about how the UK plans to face this challenge of European Islamists being radicalized in Syria and then coming back home, this concept of the foreign fighters.
There are several things that we're doing to try to counter this threat. One of them is to try to discourage our own young Muslims from taking part in the brainwashing radicalization process, which in some cases leads them to leap on a bus or a plane and go off to Syria and do jihad and join ISIL, many of whom, of course, very disappointed when they get there. But we don't want any more of our subjects going to become foreign fighters out there, because that strengthens ISIL's capability there, and it adds to the risk that they will return radicalized to our country as foreign fighters. So there's a lot of work we need to be done at community level, at family level, to try to discourage those British subjects who are Muslim, many of whom have been born in the country, from getting involved in this poisonous ideology. Then the second thing we are doing is to make sure that our borders are as effective as they can be. We don't want people leaving the country to go there, although we are a free country, so you can't always stop people with a passport and so on getting out of the country, unless they're on a warning list. But it's also ensuring that people who are coming back with terrorist intent, with or without weapons and explosives and so on, are picked up at the border before they can do that. So that means vigilant border controls, careful examination of the intelligence. It also means that over time, we are going to have to find ways, all of us as governments, to improve our ability within the law to conduct the collection of data from the communications that these people are carrying out. How do those people who slaughtered all those innocent civilians in Paris communicate? They were using mobile apps. You know, they were using things like Telegram and Snapchat and so on, and WhatsApp. You know, these are ways of communicating which are pretty hard for the rest of us to keep an eye on. And we're going to have to address that question both in the legal framework and in consultation with the companies concerned to try to ensure that where necessary, where we're talking about threats to the national security of our citizens, there are ways in which we can have a chance of finding these communications before they blow the next airplane out of the sky or before they slaughter another 100 people in the streets of a major European or American city. So that's part of the challenge as well. And then the other element is we have to try to deal with not so much just our radicalized homegrown, if you like, jihadis, but it's also to try to remove the cause of the problem in the countries concerned where many of those people originate. We have to engage with the people on the ground in the countries where there is no governance and where there is no hope and where there is no prosperity. So trying to deal with the problem at source in the region is a very important part of what we are trying to do. at the level of internet and the brainwashing and the methodology that these people are using to brainwash our young people, we're pretty active on that too. The British government has taken down tens of thousands of poisonous, hate-filled material from the internet, which is specifically designed to encourage people to go out and slaughter their fellow human beings. That is not about freedom of speech. That is about preserving liberty. So we're pretty much on the front foot in that area too.
Well, thank you for that very comprehensive response. Statistics say that approximately 750 British citizens have gone off to Syria and then returned. So certainly there is a very imminent threat in the UK, Mr. Ambassador. And just a quick follow-up, and that is, again, there's this balance between maintaining civil liberties and, of course, the need for security. To what extent is there an equivalent of the Molenbeek neighbourhood in Brussels in the UK, in the London area perhaps in particular? And what are you doing to try to combat the threat, not just, you know, crackdowns? Because, of course, there's also the trade-off. You know, these crackdowns can further radicalize communities. How do you reconcile these issues?
This problem has to be addressed with great sensitivity, obviously. I think that in the UK, we have unfortunately got young, vulnerable Muslims, some already radicalized, some potentially in the future, all over the country. It doesn't really matter much where they live. I don't think there's any pocket of any particular city in the UK that I would want to identify as being problematic. I think what we have to deal with is the individuals, the families, the communities, the faith leaders, and sometimes the disillusionment of some of the individuals. One of the wake-up calls for people in Britain after the terrorist attacks in 2005 was that a number of the people who were killing themselves and their fellow Londoners were homegrown, professional, university-educated, middle-class people, wives, families, alcohol-drinking, pornography-watching, young people. And yet there they were in what they call the name of God, going out to slaughter other people for the sake of it. So, you know, we have to tackle the mentality of people, and it's not just about corners of cities, it's about the overall approach that we have to take. And it's not about looking at our Muslims collectively. You know, the vast majority of Muslims in the United Kingdom are utterly law-abiding citizens who are appalled at the things that is being done in the name of their religion or their faith or their God. So it's very important not to alienate or to somehow categorize groups simply because of the actions of a small number of individuals. We have to focus on those individuals, those vulnerabilities, their friends, their families, their actions. Good intelligence, good police work, and absolutely not give our other law-abiding, hard-working citizens a sense that somehow they are caught up in this process and deemed to be responsible for crimes which they're absolutely not responsible for. It's a delicate balance.
Sir Peter, of course, we know there are large Muslim communities in France, all over Europe, and of course in the UK, but the UK seems to have a different model of integration. I'd like you to discuss that very briefly, how your model of integration of these communities, particularly the Muslim communities, how that contrasts with the French model. Some are quite critical of the French model, saying that, well, they talk about égalité, fraternité, liberté, but these immigrants are not well integrated, and that is part, not certainly the only reason that there is so much terrorism, but part of the problem. How does the UK differ in that regard?
How have we gone about this? Well, we're all doing different things. I don't think there is any magic formula. Obviously, there have been some problems in some of the big banlieues, the big suburbs of France and the big cities. We have had problems in certain cities of our own. We have been, I suppose, a little bit more multicultural rather than assimilatory in
exactly.
terms of the policy that we have taken. But we've had to adapt that as well. Just like in France, people are adapting the model, the way in which these issues are handled. There was a time not very long ago, for example, when children in parts of the north of England could go to school and there was no obligation to learn English because, you know, we allowed them to be themselves. But we have come to the conclusion that if people are going to make a success of their lives in Britain, they've got to be part of Britain. They've got to accept British values, British language, British rules. So you have to adapt a bit. So I think we're all looking at this afresh to try to ensure that our immigrant communities, who play such an important part of our lives in so many ways, are as integrated as they can be, are as comfortable as they can be with their adopted country, and hopefully become less and less inclined to be brainwashed by this nonsense which these extremists are peddling.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA. Our very special guest on this edition of the program is Sir Peter Westmacott. He's the British ambassador to the United States. Well, Mr. Ambassador, let's go to the so-called migrant, the refugee crisis now afflicting Europe. It was bad enough before the Paris attacks, but now it has taken on a new twist here in this country, as you know, with the campaign 2016. Candidates, both the Republican and Democratic, are talking about what to do with the many refugees that President Obama has pledged to accept, that is, those coming from Syria. And really, one could say 10,000 is a drop in the bucket, but even that is becoming more and more controversial because of the fear that maybe one out of these many thousands could potentially, you know, have terrorist links. What is the discussion or the talks in Britain regarding the migrant crisis? Are you planning to take in Syrian refugees? What is your position?
Yes, we are. Immigration is a sensitive subject in the UK, just as it is in many other countries, including the United States. In our case, we're a relatively small country with a pretty high population, 70 million people, in a country which is, in landmass terms, you know, not much more than a third the size of France. So there are issues in Britain over migration. In terms of Syria, we're very clear. There's two main strands to the British policy. One is that we have given $1.5 billion already in terms of financial support to the refugee camps in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, and in Iraqi Kurdistan, where so many of the people fleeing their own country in Syria have taken refuge. So we've given more than anybody else in Europe in terms of helping to ensure that the short-term humanitarian needs of the refugees are looked after. Second thing we're doing is that we have announced that we're taking another 20,000 Syrian refugees in addition to 5,000 we'd already agreed to take, and we're getting on with that now very actively. I had a minister here visiting Washington just last week to look at ways in which we can work together on the screening, because as you rightly suggest, it's all very well to say, let's have lots more Syrian refugees so that these poor people have got a future, or at least a temporary safe haven for a number of years until we hope their country is fit for them to return to. But we have to make sure that by being opening and welcoming to the refugees, that we're not opening the door, if you like, to some of the terrorists who we clearly do not want to come into our own country. So we're striking a balance. In the British government's case, we are focusing on those who are already, if you like, registered in the refugee camps, and we're focusing on those who are in greatest humanitarian need, the women and the children, rather than people who have just arrived off the boat where they've taken their life into their own hands trying to cross, for example, from Greece to Turkey or from Libya to Italy. So yes, we are definitely doing our part and trying to help in that area, as well as engaging very strongly with the other members of the international community in trying to find the political solution to the problems in Syria, which is going to be the biggest single thing that will stop the flow of these very large numbers.
Absolutely. And that leads me to the question of the Syrian civil war, Mr. Ambassador. Most people see President Bashar al-Assad as the major point of contention. He is seen by most, with the exception of Russia and Iran, as both starting and fueling the war after he cracked down on peaceful protesters in 2011. In the view of the UK, is Bashar al-Assad part of the problem or potentially part of the solution to defeating ISIL, so-called Islamic State?
He's very much part of the problem, if not the origin of the problem. It is because of Bashar al-Assad's policies that 250,000 people and counting in Syria have lost their lives, some in the most brutal conditions. So he can't be part of the solution. Even if the outside world thought, oh, well, let's work with Bashar al-Assad, that's not what the people of Syria would accept. So what we're doing, in addition to dealing with the terrorist threat from ISIL and a number of other al-Qaeda-associated organizations, is trying to get going with the political track so we can have a political transition to a new form of government in Syria, which will stop the war, create the ceasefires, and give the Syrian people a chance of a new life in their own country. The achievement that we've got so far, largely thanks to John Kerry's energetic diplomacy, is that at least all the different governments which are backing different groups and have an interest in Syria or have been propping up the Assad regime have come together in a political process which we were calling Geneva and we're now calling Vienna. And there is movement in that direction. The one thing that I think we're all insisting upon is that the solution cannot include President Bashar al-Assad remaining in power. There's a how and there's a when which needs to be sorted out, but we do not believe that he is part of the solution. And increasingly, the other governments concerned are moving in that direction.
Well, of course, Russia's intervention in Syria recently has simply complicated the situation. Do you see him shifting in any way? Because, of course, ISIL took credit for downing the Russian airliner over Sharm el-Sheikh. But once again, we're not really seeing too much of a difference on the ground. Do you think that Russia, Putin's Russia, can play a constructive role? Some say unless he's willing to stop attacking the so-called moderate rebels, which one would hope would be part of the solution down the line, and also stop propping up Bashar al-Assad, that they aren't playing a very constructive role.
Well, we did not regard the Russian military intervention, the doubling down on Assad, as a helpful development. The Russians said, oh, we're here to help in the fight against ISIL, but 85-90% of the airstrikes conducted by Russian aircraft have been against the moderate opposition, not against ISIL. The risk is you have more of a polarized choice between either Bashar al-Assad on the one hand or ISIL on the other, which leaves nothing in the middle for ordinary moderate Syrian civilians who want to go about their business and have a government that is inclusive and gives them a chance of a reasonable future. That is not good for Russia. They are as alarmed by ISIL as many other governments, and propping up Assad and simply attacking the moderate opposition and leaving ISIL in power is a very poor solution for the longer term as well. So Russia is in there. Russia probably does not want to be there indefinitely. That is not a good or a safe place for them to be. ISIL deliberately linked the destruction of the airliner with the loss of more than 200 lives to Russian intervention against them in the Syrian civil war. I think that there is a possibility that as Russia grasps that Assad cannot survive that much longer, why did they intervene? They intervened because their guy was weak, not because he was strong. You know, let's bear that in mind, that they should be, in our view, increasingly ready to go along with the political process with which they were originally involved back in Geneva, but which went nowhere, which means that they no longer have to be there propping up the regime and slaughtering people. Russians have probably killed 450 civilians already with their airstrikes by not targeting intelligently or reasonably against the real villains of the peace. So there is a reasonable possibility that as they sit round the table, as they confer on the political track, as they engage with other governments on a transitional arrangement which gives Syria a chance of a future, that they will become more constructive. We're not there yet. We have a number of policy differences with the way that Russia has acted so far. But it is the best way forward if we're going to have a political track for it to be inclusive and for all the governments that have a major role or major influence inside Syria to be part of that solution. That gives it its best chance of success.
We'll go to a brief break and then we'll talk briefly about climate talks and, of course, trade. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is His Excellency Sir Peter Westmacott, British Ambassador to the United States. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Ibrahim Ahmed Gagne from Adamawa State in northeastern Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, Sir Peter Westmacott, let me ask you about the EU referendum on staying within the European Union or not, perhaps in 2017. Prime Minister David Cameron has said that there will be a referendum. Talk about what the UK position is on staying within the European Union or leaving.
Britain's position is actually very clear. There are a lot of people in the United Kingdom who feel that Europe is not working as well as it should. And they feel also that Britain doesn't get an entirely fair deal. There are a number of issues which the Prime Minister has now drawn to the attention of the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, and explained that here are the areas in which the United Kingdom needs to see improvements. Some of it's about the competitiveness of the European Union, which everybody agrees with. Some it's about better management of migration issues and what we might call benefit tourism, the extent to which people can come to the UK and draw on benefits, and some of that may need to be changed. Some of it is about governance, that is to say, ensuring that decisions taken by the Eurozone, the single currency area of which we are not a part, do not affect the economic activities and the financial services sector, for example, of the United Kingdom, without us having our say in any of those decisions. And some of it is about the whole question of what we call in the jargon subsidiarity. In other words, the extent to which decisions can be taken at national level, where possible, or European level, where necessary. And that is a concept which comes from the Dutch, not just from the British. So there are a number of reforms and improvements that Britain wants to see, but so do many other governments. The Prime Minister has set out his stall. He is already engaged in a very strong negotiation with other heads of government and with the European Union institutions itself. We will be on the agenda for the December European Council. I do not know when we will reach agreement on this. I do not know whether we will reach an agreement on this. We hope that we will. The Prime Minister's strategy is to secure those improvements in the way that European institutions work and the way in which Britain is treated by the rest of the European Union, with a view, if he gets satisfaction on those issues, to campaigning in the referendum for Britain to stay in. But if we don't have those improvements, if Europe is not able to make those changes, then, frankly, all options are still on the table and, you know, we might go the other way.
Of course, this December, Mr. Ambassador, there'll be the COP21 climate talks in Paris. And of late, we've been reading that the British government has slashed support for solar and other forms of renewable energy, throwing into doubt Britain's legendary commitment to clean or green power, green energy. It has always been considered rather at the vanguard of efforts to combat global warming. How do you account for this reversal? What does that mean for your position going into the climate talks?
Well, there hasn't been a reversal. I think somebody's got the wrong end of the stick here. The British government remains absolutely committed to its policy of reducing dependence on fossil fuels, promoting renewables, and a low-carbon, high-growth economy. So we remain where we were. The only thing, if you like, that is changing as we pursue those objectives is that we are trying to ensure that the alternative forms of energy other than burning fossil fuels are economically viable and not dependent on taxpayer handouts and subsidies. So we're trying to move towards that direction. We've got the largest installed offshore wind power in the world, in the United Kingdom, because the wind blows very strongly in the North Sea. We're doing an awful lot on solar power, even though everybody laughs and says Britain has rain all the time. But actually we have sunshine too, and the technology is getting better and better. So we're still supporting very strongly the development of solar power. But what we are trying to do is to reduce the subsidies on the installed wind power facilities we've got in the UK, because we believe increasingly that as the technology improves and the costs come down, that these forms of energy need to be viable in their own right. But the government's commitment to a greener economy and to ensuring that we are burning much less in terms of CO2 and less fossil fuels in terms of power generation in the UK is absolutely unchanged.
With respect to trade, Mr. Astor, of course, President Barack Obama is very much pro-trade. We are trying to get the TPP approved in Congress. But, of course, there's also the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TTIP, which would be an agreement between the United States and most of Europe. What is the British position on that particular agreement?
British position is very much the same as that of the President of the United States. We're great believers in free trade in the UK. That's how the British Empire, if you like, was established, investment, trade, open borders. And we remain very keen. We welcome foreign investment throughout our industry. We welcome private capital in the development of our national infrastructure. We welcome the reduction of barriers and tariffs. And we welcome anything that goes towards harmonizing the professional standards, the qualifications, the regulatory frameworks, and so on, which provide safety, but which, if they're too mixed and muddled and incompatible, turn out to be barriers to trade. So we are very keen on a comprehensive TTIP. My Prime Minister has campaigned vigorously for it. My embassy here in the United States has drawn attention and has financed some independent studies explaining the advantages for the United States of America, state by state. If we got a comprehensive TTIP agreement, on average, probably each state in this country would see its exports to the European Union going up by as much as a third. We think that's a pretty good deal. It creates prosperity, it would create more jobs. So we hope very much this will get done. We have fast-track authority from the United States Congress, but the only agreement that's being concluded is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that is proving a little bit problematic. I think it'll go through the Congress, and we hope that it will give a little bit of a wind in the sails to the TTIP negotiation so that we can get that negotiation done and dusted. We'd be thrilled if it were possible to do it in the life of this administration. But the fundamental point is that my government, British business, and all the foreign investors that we've got in the United Kingdom coming from the United States seem to me to be strongly in favour of making a success of this negotiation.
His Excellency Sir Peter Westmacott is the British ambassador to the United States. Sir Peter, I can't thank you enough for your time. Terrific insights.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.